So this does sound differently, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So I'm gonna give you a few minutes just to kind of take a look at these, okay? And then we'll dig in. The one that we'll actually start with is the one that has the single bar on it. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about the narrative that's on the colored piece of paper, and then finally the larger depiction with all the color. Okay, so we'll just kind of work through all of these. So this is the third in a series of talks on mindful investigation, which is a topic that I consider really exciting, because if you get this right, this part, it takes every aspect of practice that we work with and brings it together. You know, this principle that I've kind of tried to stress of how everything is interconnected and interrelated, interdependent. And if you don't get this piece right, it's the reverse. You continue to be kind of confused of how things fit together and why are they and how are they interdependent and interrelated. So I think that structurally, seeing some of this and approaching it this way may be helpful for some people. Mindful investigation is basically the experiential exploration, you know, the direct, non-conceptual exploration of the foundational characteristics and qualities of our experience. So it's going below our normal conceptual or narrative way of understanding and figuring things out. That's the fundamental nature of it and the fundamental difference from the way that we're operating most of the day, Okay. And the first little graphic entitled "The Basic Engine of a Sound, Resilient, and Renewing Practice: Mindful Investigation." I think the value of this is, well, why is it separate and apart from the fact that this brings everything together? Why is mindful investigation valuable? I mean, we know that its purpose is to produce cognitive and intuitive insight, in what in this tradition we call wisdom. So that's its purpose. So I mean, that's obvious. But it has this whole other value that it brings things together and creates interest and energy and satisfaction and a sense of joy and inspiration. The method itself, and that's what this is attempting to depict. So we start off with mindful investigation, which we're going to explore, at least partially what that is. That's the other chart. And once that starts to work, you know, once you start watching your experience with a more refined and careful attention, a relaxed attention, and things start becoming more clear as like, well, what's actually happening and why it's happening and what are the causes of them happening and what are the different factors or conditions that are influencing it? Well, things really start to get interesting because you're actually beginning to understand your mental life, your emotional life, your intuitive life, your behavior, your speech in a different way. So it generates interest, it generates curiosity, and then the sustained focus in this way actually creates energy in your body. So we need a certain level of effort to sustain our practice. We know that. We need a certain level of effort to be able to continue to be mindful in a relatively continuous way. And the actual process of investigation, mindful investigation, generates energy. It's a source of energy generation in the body and the mind. So it's pretty amazing. So then once it starts to work, once you begin to have understanding, cognitive understanding, you begin to have spontaneous insight and wisdom. And once that starts to happen, even at a minor level, even at a small level, you begin to have a sense of satisfaction. It's like, wow, this thing really works. This has a potential to inform my life and what I do and what I think and how I feel in a different way. And so you begin to actually get a sense of satisfaction from your effort and from the investigative process. And then that leads to what I'm calling here investigative joy, this sense of lightness and joy. You could call it a form of happiness that's associated with satisfaction. But it's not just, well, I'm satisfied. It's like, no, it's this light. This is good. You know, it brightens things up. And then the impact of all of that is it leads to inspiration. Because the first time that you see very clearly into some way that you've hurt yourself or someone else, or you've been in a situation where you've used your mindfulness to respond in a way that is really helpful or kind or compassionate, and you recognize that you wouldn't have done that quite that way before, that acts as a real inspiration. Like, gee, maybe there's something really here for me and for my life. So it's this progressive thing, and it just keeps renewing itself, right? So the more it happens, the stronger all of these gets. You begin to learn how to generate interest. You learn how to generate effort. The satisfaction becomes stronger. The sense of happiness or joy becomes stronger. The inspiration starts to push your practice more directly, and it's a renewing cycle. So does that make sense?
Yes, okay.
So the narrative handout entitled "Two Basic and Radically Different Ways of Understanding Experience," you know, we talk about this all the time. We all know this, and I'm just trying to frame this in a slightly different way to see if we can to help make this more practical in relationship to the investigative process. So as a fundamental premise of Buddhist practice, there are fundamentally two different ways that we can look at our experience. The way that we look at our experience most of the time, most of the day, is through a constructed idea of who we are and our relationship to the world that has slowly developed over a lifetime and is selective, highly selective, and reinforcing. This is the reason that we can think that we quote, are, or a part of us is so terrible. And everyone around us thinks just the reverse about that same issue, okay? Because the mind is selecting out facts that support that premise, either downplaying, diminishing, or ignoring the other ones and supporting this narrative. So we develop a narrative, a viewpoint of the world. And this is the reason, by the way, to explain our political situation in the country. I mean, how is it that we can have people so radically and passionately and irrationally on both sides, completely irrationally, seeing things the exact same thing, like in totally different ways, and they're actually not seeing the same thing, right? Because they're filtering it through this constructed view that is in large part, if not in major part, based on a series of assumptions, belief, projections, frequently, which are inaccurate or are unsupportable. And so that whatever worldview we have, to some degree, is inaccurate and distorted. It's never reflective of the whole. And so that's the starting place, the starting place for Buddhist practice. And it's the reason that to be a good practitioner, you have to actually have a lot of humility. Because our mind wants to tell us that we're right. You know, that the way we're seeing it is in fact the way it is. And usually that our view is actually the better view. And so, you know, the Buddha was very clear. I can talk about this because I never feel this way. I just see other people doing it. But the Buddha was really clear about this, that, you know, how dangerous that is and how inaccurate it is, and that you actually have to be willing to be humbled in the face of seeing how inaccurate that view can be when you think it's actually the right view. To always be open to that possibility. You know, never close that possibility off. And that leads to one of the primary tools, which is suspending judgment. Right? When we're in sitting meditation or mindfulness and watching things, primary tool is suspending judgment, trying to be able to see things as they are, without all of the projections, the assumptions, the beliefs, all this stuff layered on top of it, okay? Really difficult, but that's kind of the job. Okay? So that's the narrative perspective which tends to dominate our thinking. Okay? From the Buddhist perspective, the second perspective, you can call it a lot of different things, I'm calling it here foundational, is that it is seeing into the nature, the characteristic, the process of bare experience itself, which lies, however you want to view it, beneath or behind the narrative. Okay, and the purpose of and the value of that is that through applied, sustained, continuous mindful investigation, we begin to understand our experience and our narrative in a different way. We begin to see how constructed the narrative is and how fragile it is, and we don't see our experience through the narrative. We see it through this direct experience. And over a period of time, very slowly, what that starts to do is change how we relate to our narrative. We start off by believing our narrative. It's like, well, gee, I feel really inadequate, you know, and then I am inadequate. And now I'm acting inadequate. Okay? And so it slowly starts to change our understanding of that and then change the way we relate to it, and it starts to transform it and then slowly begins to liberate us from that. We begin to see that, first of all, the problem is not whether the narrative is true or not. That's not the issue. The issue is that we are attached to believing that it's true and then identifying with it and acting in a certain way. So the foundational approach of looking at the process itself is attacking the attachment and the belief. It's not trying to change the past. It really doesn't matter what the past is. The problem is when I think of, because the past is over. Mm-hmm. All we're getting is our remembrance or a recollection of the past or our belief about the past in the present. So from a practice perspective, the problem isn't that something happened to us in the past or whether it did happen to us and we're making it up. The issue is right now when I think of that thing, what happens? And that's what the practice works on. Because if we can diffuse that, if we can take that apart, then that reaction starts to change. And the reaction is the whole problem. So if I can suddenly not be so triggered, believe so deeply, be so attached, be so identified with whatever it is, then I suddenly have what? The space for my to be able to consider that it's not true, that there's another way of seeing it, that there are other ways of behaving, and options, you know, starts to expand. So one way to think of insight and wisdom is the expansion of consciousness. You talk with anybody who's practiced for, you know, a long time, and they will tell you that things just keep feeling bigger and bigger and bigger and lighter and lighter and lighter. And that's the reason. Because this relationship starts off really tight. You know, I'm holding on really tight to the idea that, like, I'm whatever it is. And then pretty soon this starts lightening up a little bit and lightening up, and then, you know, I'm actually not even holding on to it. I'm still relating to it, but I'm not holding on to it anymore. So it just keeps going and, you know, and going. So let's look at the chart, which hopefully doesn't look too daunting. And I think once we go through it, you'll see that it's very practical. And the one called the Developmental Process of Mindful Investigation. And as I mentioned, the reason that I have different colors here is that I'm hoping that they help to visually and kind of physically understand that these are actually different things and in terms of processes have different functions. Okay? So if we start with the premise that the purpose of mindful investigation is insight or wisdom, then we're over, if you look at the 1, 2, 3, the fifth box, it says result, and we've got cognitive and intuitive insight. We could put, I probably should have in the next one, I will, put paren wisdom. That's what we call insight in this practice. So the purpose of the experiential investigation of the underlying characteristics of nature is to produce that, and the result is, the next one over, is that a change actually takes place in the relationship that we have with whatever it is that we're watching. This is the fundamental thing that is happening. And it shifts, you know, depending on what it is, how strong the insight is, whether we reflect on it, whether we try to act on it, you know, back to these four elements of practice: study, reflection, practice, and then evaluation of practice, depending on how much we're doing that, okay? It creates a shift or an expansion of our relationship with whatever it is. And this is the key idea, because everything is about relationship here. Nothing exists absent relationship, our relationship with it. Whether it's a thought, an emotion, a feeling, if there isn't a relationship, we're not conscious. And this is the reason that practice is so dynamic, is that that relationship, which generates everything we do and how we feel and what we think, is changing moment to moment based on conditions. That's the reason it can be bewildering at times, and why it's so exciting, and why it's so hopeful, because you can change that relationship, okay? So then the relationship changes through our having a different understanding. And really importantly, it changes our intention. And we know in this practice that the intention is the driver of everything, right? It's the karmic driver. Like if I intend to do something, that inclines my mind to do that. It inclines my emotional perspective. It inclines my speech. If I don't have any intention at all, what happens? I'm just reacting in the moment, right? But if I actually have a pretty clear intention, it tends to push or drive or direct what I think, how I feel, where I'm going. And frequently, if not most of the time, we have mixed intentions. And this is a function of this process. It's called purification. That we get clearer and clearer about our intention and connected with it. And so the answer to the question, well, why is it that I consider myself, you know, such a, I consider myself a pretty compassionate person, and then I do these decidedly uncompassionate things. Like I had this experience last night that was embarrassing and humiliating and humbling. And I have these two little Karen Terriers that I really love. And they've been with me for, this is the 12th year. And they're really devoted to me. And one of them in particular, you know, is like glued to me at the hip. You know, it's like any room I go into, he's with me. If I'm on the phone and I'm experiencing difficulty and I'm angry, if I look over at him, you will see his body posture change in response. I mean, it's really amazing. So we kind of have this whole routine when we go to bed, and they know when I do certain things, you know, when I turn certain lights off and everything, it's like, okay, you know, we're heading for the bedroom. So I do all of this, and he's kind of hesitating. And I had done what I shouldn't have been doing, and I was watching one of the political news shows just before I went to bed. So I was kind of agitated and didn't realize it. So he's being very slow and everything, and I'm kind of going, hey, Obi, come on. Like, it's time to go to bed, you know? And he's hesitating and everything. So finally, I don't normally do this. I just pick him up and I put him on the bed. And the reason he was hesitating was that he had done the dog thing. You know, he had eaten something on his walk that had upset his stomach, and the minute I put him on the bed, he just go, plow, you just all over the bed. I mean, just a terrible stinky mess. I mean, just, and this is about, I don't know, 11:45, and I'm agitated and don't know it, and I get really pissed off. You know, I'm kind of ranting and everything. And then I look over at him, and he's just sitting there like, oh, my God, Dad, why are you doing that to me? You know, I feel terrible. And so, you know, that's an illustration. Like, well, gee, I'm kind of a compassionate person. Like, what the fuck was that, you know? And so, you know, these urges that we have and deep habits, mental formations are really, really deep. It takes a long time to purify them. You really have to work on it. And so you can see from that as much as I, you know, have kind of like a conscious intention, which has embedded itself in, I think, the vast majority of my conduct, there is that embedded someplace in my body and my mind, and under the right circumstances will present itself. You know, very, very humbling thing. So that starts to get purified, and the number of times that happens starts to change. And the reason is that through this process we begin to see at an intuitive, not just an intellectual, but an intuitive, deeply experiential level into the nature of things, and intuitively start changing our conduct. I mean, like that thing last night, and I'm not, you know, being facetious or light. Once I realized what was going on and what I was doing to that little animal, was terrible for me. You know, it took me hours to go to sleep once I realized it. And I believe that's because of my practice, because I was able to see so clearly and appreciate the consequence to him. You know, not just, gee, that was really screwed that I did that and everything. Okay, I'll go to bed now. But, you know, like to really feel it, that's what happens. And then that's motivational. That begins to work on your intention. So your intention changes, and then your thought and your conduct and how you, all of those things are engaging in relationship with other people and the world and animals begins to change. They begin to shift and to expand. So that's the line, okay, from the two different views, okay, of experience to the purpose and to the result. That's how those fit together. So what is mindful investigation? And I have been sharing some of these with folks and getting their comments on it. And those of you who got the drafts of these, even as late as last night, will notice that I've continued to make changes on them, because the more you sit with anything that's physical like this, you see relationships. So I'd like to make the comment that so somebody wrote back and basically said, gee, you know, I'm never quite sure if I'm doing it right or if the effort I'm putting in is producing the right results, and, you know, am I experiencing enough of this in sittings and what have you. And I'd just like to say that it's helpful to remember that we're doing something new, at least in my opinion, in the West with this practice. And what it is that we are using teachings and methodologies that historically have been intended for use only in intense, secluded, monastic settings. So my guess is that 70% of the suttas, the discourses that we talk about and try to translate into, you know, everyday language, were not being taught to lay people at the time of the historical Buddha. And so these techniques are, you know, the Buddha is really clear, this is a training. And unless you take it that way, you know, like you really want to put some effort into it, lots of this remains beyond our grasp, because it requires some effort. And, you know, there, whether it's juggling or playing the piano or learning how to do mindful investigation, there's a learning process. And there's this piece of, like, conceptually, intellectually, getting a structure of what it means. That's what we're trying to do with this. And then you start to experiment with it, and it always, for some period of time, frequently a long period of time, kind of feels mechanical and awkward, because you're trying to remember what to do, you know, before you can actually do it. And then you start to be able to do it, and then slowly it actually becomes a skill. You know, so then you start playing with it, and then it starts becoming a habit. You know, and then over a period of time, moving into like almost like second nature, and then eventually, it just becomes kind of embedded. You know, it becomes a way of seeing things and hearing things and relating to things. So that's a big process. And when we're talking about things that are as deep as we're talking about, like this, you know, I use the illustration with Opie, my dog, because it's pretty safe. But I could give you some illustrations that aren't so safe. And probably all of us could, in terms of our relationships with other people, or, you know, what we think about ourselves or how we've hurt ourselves, you know. So it's deep stuff, and so I wouldn't be too hard on yourself in working with this. I would just work with it. That was the Buddha's advice, you know. In the Kalama Sutta, the sutta where he's talking about, you know, don't believe something just because someone is knowledgeable or a leader or it's in a sacred text or because it's logically makes sense. None of that. Do it based on your experience and what the result is. Does it produce the kind of results we're talking about? And then the part that doesn't get much play is the second part of the sutta says there's all these big questions and that we're always asking. And the Buddha basically says, you know, just stop it. You know, just knock it off, because you'll never figure those things out by trying to figure them out. That what we're dealing with here is beyond conceptual or intellectual discovery. And you'll never find the answers. So the answer actually is just practice and see what happens. You know, just keep following that, and it'll take you to the right place. Wherever you're supposed to go, it'll take you there. Okay. So, why the different colors and what do we have here? So, we're talking about mindful investigation being the careful and refined paying of attention to our experience. And from the structure of this particular practice, the first two, we can divide, and if you'll look at some of the material, the essays on our website, we stressed a lot very early, all of us, in when we were teaching, that there were qualities of experience and there were characteristics. So the first two columns that are in the same color, we are observing, seeing, experiencing the bare experience of the qualities of these factors, okay? So the first column is actually how experience just keeps arising over and over and over and over again, okay? So there is a sense object, you know, the one we always use, the bell, okay? There's contact with it, sound waves, hits my sense door, consciousness arises, my mind automatically classifies that, whether I want to or not. I know that's a bell. I don't think it's a turkey, okay, or an alligator. Just boom. That's perception, categorization. And simultaneously with the arising of consciousness, perception, the third thing is a feeling tone of that of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Okay, so that's what's happening over and over and over and over and over it continuously for until we no longer have consciousness. Okay? So that's the fundamental start of everything. And each one of those, we can experience those as having a quality. What would be a quality? We all know the answer to this. I'm just putting a term on it. So let me do the second one and then it'll be easier. So the second column is the primary, not all, but the primary elements of the first, second, and third foundation of mindfulness, what we call it. And basically, it's sensations in our body, feeling tone, the whole range of emotionally related mind states, moods, thinking, not the content of thinking, but the process of thinking, and then those all relating to each other, right? So when we hit this, if we actually ask people, which we do sometimes, like what happened, well, some people will say, well, you know, I heard that and it reminded me of. And well, I heard that and it made me feel so relaxed. Or I heard that and I immediately started thinking of. Okay, so these things are different dimensions of this experience arising that are all coming together. Okay? So everything that is on the bottom half of those first two has qualities. And the qualities are things like intensity, okay, strength, okay, like there's... That's really a different experience, right? Yeah, and it's a, it like it's fun doing it because like several people you look at them and it kind of pisses them off. Why do you have to do that? So that yeah. So you know, this shows, I mean, how interconnected and synergistic and dynamic and interdependent this all is. You know, like just the difference in effort that I use on this is going to create a myriad of different reactions in the room. And all of those are reactions are based on those people's individual histories with things all coming together. Okay? So it's things like strength, intensity, with a sensation it could be the depth of a feeling, the strength of it. It could be temperature. So all of these different things that we all talk about in beginning meditation classes, everything on the left hand, on the first two columns on the bottom, have these qualities, and what the investigative experience is about is paying attention and noticing. Okay, so I hit that, and ooh, that was very strong, and I didn't like it. You know? And if you have a reaction that is involuntary, which most of them are, okay, until we start being, is like, well, that kind of pissed me off, and I'm kind of pissed off now. Like, you know, like, oh, okay, like, I'm pissed off now. You know, that's the mindfulness piece. Like, okay, now I'm caught in being pissed off. You know, I'm attached to and I'm identified with the reaction. So I'm trying to go beneath that, and by beneath it, I can see it. Does that work? I mean, that's the beauty of this, if it's working. You know, is that we actually see it, and we see it viscerally. And then we have a choice. So all of that is the regular process that we're doing over and over in sitting meditation. You know, we're experiencing sensation in our foot, or a temperature on our foot, or that our stomach hurts, or that a thought comes up and now I'm feeling sad, or whatever it may be. You know, we're just trying to suspend judgment, and it says here, trying to watch this with care. We really care about it because it's about our life and we can change our life with kindness, with balance, with some balance, equanimity, okay? And with, to the degree we can, with a relaxed mind. You know, so we're trying to hold the experience and receive it, not try to manage it or do something with it. So the next column, the fourth foundation of mindfulness, is the characteristics. And there's three primary characteristics from a Buddhist perspective of all of our experience. Okay, so the first one is that there is continuous, dependent, and conditioned change. So that's called sometimes impermanence or sometimes called anatta. But it's continuous change. It's not just change. It's change that is conditioned by what happened before it, just like this. There was change, but how hard I hit that conditioned the experience that you had. And it's dependent. If I didn't hit this, you wouldn't have a reaction. There would be nothing to have a reaction to, right? So it's change which is conditioned and dependent. So that's the first, from a Buddhist perspective, the first most foundational and basic characteristic of experience. The second one is that the whatever happens, all of these experiences are interactive, they're connected, they're synergistic, they're relational, they're interdependent, however you want to word that, they are completely connected to each other, and there is nothing separate. It seems like it's separate because, you know, we have these separate physical bodies, but the experience that we are having, this is the key point, is all relational. It's all interconnected. It is not separate. There is no separate thing. Okay? So if I don't hit that, if that relationship doesn't occur, the sound doesn't occur, and your experience of the sound doesn't occur. It's totally dependent and conditioned, interactive, and it's synergistic and interdependent because whatever it is, all of your unique history creates the response. So, you know, if depending on how I hit that, some people feel happy, some feel mellow, some people feel, I don't even know why he's hitting it again. He keeps hitting that thing. Right? Yep. But I mean, all those things are happening, right? All off of this one little thing. And that's because of the conditions that are in your body and your mind. Okay? Unbelievably how complex it can be. So to try, at least my opinion is, and I think this is good, to try to oversimplify this is a huge mistake. And this is where I think we get in trouble with our narrative. It's like, well, if I just think about it enough, you know, there's this one thing or these couple of things, and that's responsible for everything about this. Well, if you practice for a while, maybe I'm, what do they say? It's a something alert when you're going to disclose part of the movie. Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert. It's not true. You're going to bump into that. You know, you're going to find out I've always thought X, and it's just not true. And it's not because I figured it out. It's because I had this experience, and I realize it can't be true. It can't be that simple, you know. So that's the second fundamental characteristic, which we sometimes call anatta or no self. We get all trapped in language. Well, there's no self. There's no. Well, forget about the language. Just that this thing is so interactive and interdependent, there is nothing separate, including our sense of self. Okay? And then the final one is the, you know, what we refer to as suffering, but it's basically a perception of experience where we separate from our experience, and as a result of separating, we suffer. Because now we've changed the relationship. Rather than being in a suspended judgment or non-judgmental relationship, I've pulled back, I'm making all kinds of judgments about this, and now I'm starting to suffer as a result of that. And that's an energetic experiential thing that's happening. Okay? That's dependent origination. That's the process of how we become attached to and identify with experience, which is what makes us suffer. There's a lot of different ways to word this, but basically, we're going along, everything's fine, you know, we're having a nice meal with someone. And it's great, you know. And one of the two people says something, and the other person immediately feels defensive or attacked or inadequate, and it's like this immediate, you're here like this, and it's just, poof. Does everybody know this? like boom, you know, oh man, like what did that mean, you know? And so it's that quick, boom, man, it's like now there's a sense of separation, and from that sense of separation I suffer to some degree. It might be just like a minor uncomfortableness. It might be just like a panic attack, you know, depending on history and the circumstance. But that's it. It's that clear when it happens. So that is the third fundamental characteristic, is that this perception of separation that comes from attachment and identification. So those are the three fundamental characteristics. So in our experience, we're looking in sitting or in daily life, we're looking at either these characteristics, you know, how does that feel? How strong is the reaction? What is the reaction? And the clearer I can see that, the better I can work with it, right? Or it's like, wow, this thing is so fluid that my effort right now to try to make it simple just is a mistake. Like you're in a meeting, you know? Like, man, it's really happening. You know, people are upset or they're over-enthusiastic or whatever. And you're trying to get a handle on it. And trying to get a handle on it is the problem. So it's like, okay, I'm just going to sit here and watch and listen and wait until it starts to become clear to me. Like, when I'll do practice interviews with students. And for me, this is, from the standpoint of sitting up here and working with somebody, this is one of the most fascinating experiences for me in watching myself. Because in giving this talk or doing an interview, I have to be mindfully investigating myself and my own behavior, right, while I'm doing it. So I'll be interviewing somebody and I'll say, well, tell me what's going on. And they'll start explaining things, and I can see my reaction of wanting to get a hold of it, right? The perception part, wanting to put it in a box and understand it and come up with an answer. And so if I just let go of that and just watch it, it's always kind of amazing, because what I understand that is behind that urge to do something is I don't have a clue what's going on here. It's really fascinating. Every time I catch that urge to, like, you know, it's a really strong urge to clarify and everything, and then if I just let go, like, what's behind that is I don't get it at all, and that urge is a mistake. You know, that's going to force an evaluation. So I'll just sit there, and sometimes it'll be like 50 minutes of just listening and asking questions and watching the person and exploring and everything. And, you know, like, I'll say to myself, you know, this thought will come in. It's like, well, you know, we said that we were going to get together for an hour or an hour and a half, and we're in an hour, and I don't have a clue what I'm going to do here or what I'm going to say, you know? And it's like, well, that's okay. That's fine. That's the process. And inevitably, if I stay with that, you know, just follow the basic premise of practice, just suspend judgment and just keep watching, just keep listening as deeply as you can, at some point it becomes clear how I can be helpful. And that's the fundamental process of sitting, you know. So, like, for example, if we're not doing this kind of mindful investigation of our conduct, so, you know, we big part of this practice is ethical conduct, right? Right speech, right behavior, right thought. If I'm not doing mindful investigation of that, what am I doing? I'm following a bunch of ethical rules. I'm trying to implement a bunch of ethical rules. That's all I'm doing. Because I'm not watching how it feels, the amount of effort I'm using, what the intention is, and does the intention change. Those are all the things that allow us to grow and inform, right? But if it's just a bunch of rules that I'm implementing, you know, if I am using a meditation process, well, okay, I'm going to focus on my breath, and when that's the primary anchor, and when there's something stronger, I'm going to observe that. if I'm not doing this, like, well, what are the qualities of that experience? You know, how does it feel? How deep is it? When a thought comes up, it triggers something else, seeing that that happens and why, you know, that there's this change going on. What am I doing? All I'm doing is basically sensory awareness and relaxing. So this investigation piece is the piece that makes everything come alive and leads to insight. Okay. So I think, okay, so I didn't realize that I'm working. So I think I'm going to stop there and just take a minute or two if there are observations or questions or thoughts about this, and if this has been helpful, or if it hasn't been helpful, or it's been more confusing than it's been helpful. Yeah, and I could hit the bell again, too.
Kind of results, cognitive and intuitive insight, or wisdom, and then how that gets integrated in change. Does judgment fall in, come into play? You know, there's intention, and I think of judgment as in a kind of wise application to intention. And then it circles right around again back to the beginning, and we take a non-judgmental perspective on what we're looking at. In other words, we try and be non-judgmental about the narrative, leave it alone, go beneath, start experiencing foundation. And that comes out of a wisdom of yesterday's practice, where you gained a little insight, and now you're going to continue your practice. And you do it with intention, and with some sense of better judgment. So, can you close that circle for me, your judgment?
Uh-huh.
Judgment?
Yeah, and so language is a little bit tricky here, so I'll try to get to the idea, okay? So I think for this developmental process that I kind of described is happening at all a bunch of different levels, because like on one element, for example, we could have quite a bit of experience because we've paid attention to it, so that now a lot of our reactions are fairly intuitive. We're responding to experience out of second nature in this way, rather than thinking about it, how should I act, and or a combination of the two. And then there's others, even though we're very, in some cases, very sophisticated, there's others where we're back at the beginning because we haven't really applied ourselves to that. Okay? Does that make sense to everybody? So this is the reason that somebody can appear. Well, I think, frankly, this is the reason that you see the improprieties of teachers with students that we've seen in every single meditative community in the United States, including all of our own. And it's because there is an element of the teacher's maturity from this perspective that has not been fully developed. So an urge comes up, and the instinct to put that in a healthy, responsible framework, that if I take certain action, it will inevitably lead to someone else's suffering and my own just is lost. And why is it lost? Because I'm attached and I'm identified with the urge. Okay, so you can have someone who is quite a sophisticated practitioner, and then have certain parts of their life where they're not a sophisticated practitioner at all. And it's one of the reasons that you see people do therapy, is that they just get clear through this process that in real time, relationally, I've just got, I'm immature about certain things, and I need to work on that, and I need to use as many tools as I can to get up to speed, okay? So so part of this is that I have an experience and I gain a little bit of wisdom, and that changes my perspective and influences my intention. And then part of it is that intellectually, I'm realizing that that's what I need to do, and I'm applying a method or a technique, okay? And that slowly starts to work. And so one is more mechanically affecting my assessment and then how I respond to something. So traditionally in Buddhism, the term, quote, judgment kind of has some baggage, because we say to be non-judgmentally observed. By that we mean don't make evaluations, negative or positive, okay? Just, it's the bare experience of what's there. So the only reason I'm raising that is that that can be a confusing term, you know? So, we would say, well, we are able to distinguish the difference between certain acts and the consequences of them, and make sound decisions, as opposed to saying, so I'm making a skillful decision, as opposed to usually saying, well, I'm making a skillful judgment. Okay, we just, as a general rule, and I'm not endorsing this, I'm just saying, as a general rule, that's the approach you're going to hear, as opposed to particularly teachers talking about judgment being skillful or unskillful. Okay. But you get the idea, right? Yeah, so your basic idea about that it becomes cyclical is absolutely right, and it's a combination of it, you having an experience and then it intuitively starting to happen, and cognitively thinking it through and setting an intention and then applying it. It's those two elements. You've got to have both, because it's part of this developmental process. If we didn't have the, I actually have an intention to do this, it takes a lot longer. Yeah. So. Okay. Any other thought, comment? Okay. Well, thank you very much. I hope that this helped a little bit. We'll just do a very, very, very quick little closing metta. Kindness practice. So just take a minute to come back into your body. We've had a lot of thoughts and ideas and concepts, and see if you can just come back into the bare experience, the bare experience of being in your body, sitting in the chair, feeling the air moving across your skin, if you can feel the air conditioner, the coolness, the points of contact in your body, just letting go of the ideas and thoughts. And this idea of practice expanding us, I think, is very valuable, because it has to do with not just opening our mind, but opening our heart to our life and to the lives around us, and to the possibilities of suffering and of joy. So in a world where there is so much pain and suffering, may we have the aspiration that our practices in some real way help those around us and all living beings to feel a sense of safety and protection in their lives, to feel healthy and strong, to help ourselves and others feel at peace, for all beings everywhere to be able to care for themselves and feel some sense of ease in the world, and to be free from suffering.